Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Today's live stream is titled Overcoming Limiting Beliefs 2022. Overcome Limiting Beliefs 2022. Many of us started the year, we start off every year with New Year's resolutions. You might call them something different, you know, New Year's goals or whatever. Some people are successful at these resolutions, achieving these resolutions. Some are not. They have all the energy in the world the first day of the year, January 1st, the first week, and then some start to fade at the end of the month, of the beginning of the year, January, and by the time spring comes along, time March comes along, March or April, they forgot their New Year's resolutions or goals or whatever they might call them. Some might try to pick up mid-year in the summertime and say, all right, wait a minute, let me pick back up. Some make it. Probably more that don't. So as we're ending this year, we're still in November, but and we want to start building momentum now to take us into the new year of 2022. In order to definitely reach those goals. Or goal. For me, it's one primary goal, using the law of repetition on what I do. But anyway, getting back to all of us. But we need to eliminate the beliefs. Now, during this pandemic, on a global level, one of the major things that the pandemic has brought out is it has revealed a lot of people and their limiting beliefs. You know, I can't do this because I don't have money. I can't do this because I got laid off on my job during the pandemic. You know, the pandemic, a lot of us, including myself, has used the pandemic as an excuse not to do things. All right, so in order to end this year where we're building up momentum, we're no longer making excuses, so we can start off 2022 correctly and end this one correctly as well. By achieving some of these goals that we set out earlier or years earlier, we need to overcome or eliminate the self-sabotage of our personal limited beliefs. Okay. Now, if you go to our scrolling marquee on Facebook, but you know what? Since I did mention that, I'm going to load them up to Facebook right now. We need to first identify our limiting beliefs. What's holding us back? On a group level, well, you know what, maybe that's for another day. Okay. And that's why I play Jamarian Styles every morning. Jamarian Styles, who you heard his story, you know, this dude had no hands. He had no hands, but he wanted to be on the basketball team. So he didn't use his lack of hands, and he had two arms. They were basically stumps. He's still living. I've contacted him twice. I'm waiting for him to respond because I like to get him on here live. I'm going to keep on until I can get him on here live. But he didn't use his lack of hands as an excuse. He didn't allow his lack of hands to be a limiting belief that he can make the basketball team. And you heard what the coach said. He went to the basketball coach and said, "Look, I would just like to be on the team." He didn't even care about playing. He just liked to be on the team. So he went out for the team with no hands, and he made the team. As the audio stated, he and I just posted on some graphics I have for limiting beliefs. Limiting beliefs can be a ball and chain. When he finally got, you know, he didn't get to play much, but he did make the team. And, of course, a lot of players, when they don't get to play, they quit the team. They get discouraged and quit the team. But he didn't allow his lack of play, and he didn't use that as an excuse. He didn't use that he didn't have any hands. He didn't use that as an excuse either to stay on the team after he made it, because it was basically a miracle that he made it with no hands. You know, the coach could have said, "Well, if you want to be part of the team, you can be a manager or something like that." But no, he wanted to be a player with a uniform. He made the team, and he made the team over people who had hands, but he didn't have any. So, Jamarian finally got into a game, and they passed him the ball. They passed the ball. All he can do is catch it with, I guess, his body and his two stump arms with no hands. He managed to, because the coach said he was the first one to practice, and he was the last one to leave the gym. So Jamarian, although he had some physical limitations, he worked with what he had. In this case, a strong and sound mind, a body that was in good shape. He learned how to catch the ball with his two stump arms and body. He learned how to do that. He worked on that before practice. When he was allowed to practice, or allowed to get into scrimmage or game conditions during practice, he worked on it. More than likely, he worked harder than anybody on that team. So when he finally got in the game, or in a game, he shot it, and he scored a three-pointer. You know, on a three-pointer, you know, that's an outside shot. That's a long-range shot. And nobody got on him probably because he had no hands. He made it, and then the crowd went, you know, shoot it again, shoot it. And he made another one. He scored 6 points in a regulated game with no hands. Jamarion Styles had no limiting police about himself. He did not self-sabotage himself with limiting beliefs. Now, if you go to our Facebook page, It's My House TV, that's our Facebook page, It's My House TV, I just posted this. You know, limiting beliefs, they're a ball and chain on us. And then there's another illustration on there where a limiting belief, any limiting belief that you have about yourself will cause a lack of action. Jamarion didn't have a limited belief. He believed that he can go out for the basketball team with no hands and make it. And it worked out for him. He believed that regardless of no hands, that if he got into a game, he can score. And he did. He knew that he had to come to practice early to work on his skill set. And he knew he had to stay after practice to work on the skill set as well. But it worked because he didn't have any limited beliefs about himself. Now, there are other people that went out for the team, I'm sure, or could have gone out for the team, could have outperformed every player on that team, but they had a limited belief. Maybe they didn't have the sneakers or the tennis shoes, you know, to play basketball. That, by you not having something in particular, that is a self-imposed limiting belief. Because some way, somehow, if you put your mind to it, you can find a pair of shoes. Maybe somebody will loan you a pair of shoes. Maybe somebody will buy you a pair of shoes. Maybe you can get a part-time job and earn the money to buy the pair of shoes. Or maybe somebody who was knew how to play the game, but they just didn't think they were good enough for that team. But see, they never tried out, so if you don't try out, you don't get anywhere. Jamarion tried out. And even before that, he went to the coach. Coach, I'd just like to be on the team. He got points just doing that. So limiting beliefs can lead to lack of action, poor results, or no results. And the pandemic brought a whole lot of that out, including with my people like myself. You know, I needed money. I was counting on a particular source so I can buy the tools and materials that I needed to build. But when they didn't pay, I allowed myself to get into a limited belief. And mind you, I said I allowed myself. It doesn't matter whether they paid or not. Okay? Because then, all right, if I'm not going to get it from that source, what other resources are there where I can get the tools and the equipment that I need. All right, let's see. On another one of these graphs on here, or charts, they have your beliefs. Your beliefs define how you think. How you think influences how you act. How you act defines the events in your life, and the events in your life are reinforced by your beliefs. Some examples of limited beliefs: I will never be able to fulfill my dreams. I don't have the abilities to do this job. These are some things that people say that are limited beliefs. I don't have the right education. I don't have, I look too awful. It's not up to me. I'm not strong enough. I'll never be happy. I'm not worthy. I cannot change. I don't have time. Everyone's against me. The white man's against me. White supremacy. These are all limiting beliefs. I'm not good with money. Life is all problems and risk. Now, we can do a whole podcast on, because I believe white supremacy is simply a limiting belief. We can do a whole podcast on that. And if you guys want to chime in on that today, we can do that. But in any event, whatever our limiting beliefs are, we need to identify them first and then take corrective action on that. Now, for me, I had to break things down like real simple for what I do. What I'll use this podcast. We're approaching, how many podcasts have we done? Of It's My House, at least. Let me look that up real quick. I know it's over 1,900. Okay, let me look it up. Okay, I'm almost there, people. 619-768-2945 is our call-in number. Let's see. Okay, so far we've completed 1,963 It's My House. We're currently doing 1,964 right now, but we've completed 1,963. All right. Now, because what I'm looking at now is I like to have one tiny house or one, you know, I'm lumping out of this because I like different type of houses or shelters. I want to earn an income off of, for every live stream we do, I want to have, and we do 20 a month on average. Okay. I want to have 20 extreme properties built or customized by us in our business. Because imagine if I'm just thinking out loud here. 1,963 times, and let's say I was getting $100 a month from each one of those properties. and there would be $196,300 in monthly income. And you're gonna let's factor in the 80-20 rule, so minus 20%. Okay. Oh, let me get this right. All right. 1,963 times $100 a month. Okay, that's $196,300. And let's say I receive 80% of that, because let's say 25% might not pay. That's $157,000, $40 a month income. Just by doing one a day. One extreme house a day that most people would classify as a tiny house. Me and my nine friends. That's over $1 million a year, almost two. Doing Laura Nelson deals, or Lauren Nelson deals. That's buying El Tipo campers for under $1,000 or under $500. Well, she put in $800 total, $400 to buy it, $400 to fix it up, $800. So, you know, then you resell it for, you know, $200, $500, $1,000, whatever it might be. That's the one model, that and Lamar Alexander with solar, that's it. That's all I'm doing from here on out. Now, I've got a big goal that goes beyond Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000-hour rule. My goal is to do it 250,000 times. But Laura Nelson did and Lamar Alexander. How long will it take me to do that? It's going to take me some years. I've been doing this almost 8 years to get to the 1,963 podcast. And that's just what It's My House. I've done other people's podcasts, and I've produced other people's podcasts. So I've done over 2,000 myself. But just what It's My House, the thing I want going into 2022 and beyond is For every 2 hour podcast, or even every 1 hour podcast, we want a tiny house either built, or we want a camper that we renovate and customize and put it back on the market and/or keep it in rent. That's it. Oh, update on Lauren Nelson. Lauren Nelson, I said she was 11. Lauren Nelson was actually 10 years old when she did that. 10-year-old. Her 11th birthday was coming up, but she was actually 10. But she's part of my vision board, right on It's My House TV. I got a picture of her in front of her camper. I look on my phone, I look for that type of camper. I got to get back to some people. And I got people calling me now looking for the place to stay. And I rented to somebody who's got an RV, camper on wheels, that I'm going to talk to after this podcast because I'm going to propose a partnership with them. I want him to become one of my nine friends, building nine friends. In any event, we need to identify overcoming our limiting of beliefs. Like, see, the pandemic on a global level, a lot of people have used that as an excuse, and they're using the pandemic as a limiting belief. There are people during this pandemic who will become millionaires. March 2020, she didn't know anything about mobile homes. In 9 months, she made $181,000. Not knowing anything about mobile homes. And she made her share of mistakes in the process. Let me give you a reframe on mistakes. There really are no mistakes unless you quit. You either win or you learn. When you make a mistake, it's a learning experience. Get the word mistake out of your vocabulary.
Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept. So you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will, or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million, what's today, Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift. The thing God gave you at birth to do, it is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you're doing, you're wasting your time. Do you hear me? You wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you're gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody, do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody, don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids, 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, uh-oh, if you just do it 10 more times. I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me. And however, he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone. And I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and the dude said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it, I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back, and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the $150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it.
Got on plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I done had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. And they paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Thank you. I go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
We'll be out, man. I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man. You know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised at you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know?
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you going to do?
But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
He a man today. He a man.
Living the life. Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been, and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She feel like you a motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She a nigga. That nigga hurting himself. You from Nuke State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Camp Hugay.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had. And he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator, just the inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here the the very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it's the Lauren's little camper. I got this side from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
Kick him when they're down.
Today's podcast is titled Overcoming Limited Beliefs 2022. We want to overcome limiting beliefs before 2022 reaches here. There's a book that I highly recommend. It's titled Unstoppable by Cynthia Kersey, spelled with a K, Cynthia Kersey, K-E-R-S-E-Y, Cynthia Kersey wrote the book. She's written a couple of books that I know about, but this one is titled Unstoppable. 45 powerful stories of perseverance and triumph from people just like you. And there's a story in there. Matter of fact, my favorite story that she's written, one of my all-time favorite stories. I'll read a little bit of it today. Called Mission on to March. A barefoot Ulysses and his incredible story. It reads, he possessed a five-day supply of food, a Bible. Oh, matter of fact, this place in Africa. He possessed a five-day supply of food, a Bible, and a Pilgrim's Progress, his two treasures, a small axe for protection, and a blanket. With these, Lexon Kiera eagerly set out on a journey of his life. He was going to walk from his tribal village in Nyasaland, north of the wilderness of East Africa, to Cairo, where he would board a ship to America to get a college education. It was October 1958. Lexon was 16 to 17 years old. His mother wasn't sure. His parents were illiterate and didn't know exactly where America was or how far. But they reluctantly gave their blessing to his journey. To Lexon, it was a journey derived from a dream, no matter how ill-conceived, that fueled his determination to get an education. He wanted to be like his hero, Abraham Lincoln, who had risen from poverty to become an American president, then fought tirelessly to help free the slaves. He wanted to be like Booker T. Washington, who had cast off the shackles of slavery to become a great American reformer, educator, giving hope and dignity to himself and his race. Like these great role models, Lexon wanted to serve mankind, to make a difference in the world. To realize his goal, he first needed a first-rate education. He knew the best place to get it was in America. Forget that Lexon didn't have a penny to his name, or a way to pay for his ship fare. Forget that he had no idea that a college he didn't have no idea of where the first. Well, let me read this. Forget about the idea of what college he would attend, and even if he would be accepted. Forget that Cairo was 3,000 miles away and in between hundreds of tribes that spoke more than 50 different languages, none of which Lexon knew. Forget all that Lexon did. Everything out of his mind except the dream of getting to the land where he could shape his own destiny. He hadn't always been so determined. As a young boy, he had sometimes used his poverty as an excuse for not doing his best at school or for not accomplishing something. I'm just a poor child, he had told himself, what can I do? Like many of his friends in the village, it was easy for Lexan to believe that studying was a waste of time for a poor boy from a town in Karongo and Nasilan. This is in Africa, by the way, remote Africa, then in books provided by the missionaries. He discovered Abraham Lincoln and Booker T. Washington, and he did that through the books. The stories inspired him to envision more of his life, and he realized that an education was the first step. So he conceived of an idea to walk to Cairo. Now let's get a visual on this. This guy's in a place in a remote part of Africa, and he has made up in his mind that he will have to walk 3,000 miles to reach one leg of his destination. Let's look it up. And today's podcast is Overcoming Limited Beliefs. Okay, distance. Distance from, let's go New York City to, let's go with San Francisco. I'm going to go from Orlando, Florida to Seattle. Yeah, Seattle, Washington. Let's see what that distance is. To Fairbanks, Alaska. Okay. And that's over 4,000 miles. All right. Essentially, like many of his friends in the village, it was easy for Lexan to believe that studying... All right, I read that part. Okay. All right. After 5 full days of trekking across the rugged African terrain, Lexan had only covered 25 miles. There's a lot of people that listen to this podcast. You really can't even handle 2 miles. But anyway, that's another story. Lexan had covered only 25 miles out of the 3,000 miles he had to walk. He was already out of food. So we're talking about 5 days in, and he's out of food. Okay. His water was running out, and he had no water. I mean, he had no money. And remember, water is heavy. All right. The traveler distance of 2,975 additional miles seemed impossible. Yet to turn back was to give up. To resign himself to a life of poverty and ignorance. I will not stop till I reach America, he promised himself, or I will die trying. Kind strangers treated him with herbal medicines and offered him a place to rest to convalesce. Weary and demoralized, Lexan continued turning back. Perhaps it was better to go home, he reasoned, than to continue this seamlessly foolish journey and risk his life. Instead, Lexan turned to his 2 books, reading familiar words that renewed his faith in himself and his goal. He continued on. On January 19th, 1960, 15 months after he began his perilous journey, he had crossed nearly 1,000 miles to Kampala, the capital of Uganda. He was now growing stronger in body and wiser in his ways of survival. He remained in Kampala for 6 months, working at odd jobs and spending very spare moment in the library, reading voraciously. In the library, he came across an illustrated directory of American colleges. One of the illustrations, in particular, caught his eye. It was of a stately yet friendly-looking institution set beneath a pure blue sky, graced with fountains and lawns and surrounded by majestic mountains that reminded him of the magnificent peaks back home in Nyasaland.
This is a Washington State. Robin, you're real good at pronouncing this stuff.
I guess Skagit Valley College in Mount Vernon, Washington, became the first concrete image that Lexington seamlessly impossible quest. He wrote immediately to the school's dean, explaining his situation and asking for a scholarship. Fearing he might not be accepted at Skagit, Lexington decided to write to as many colleges on his meager budget that his meager budget would allow. It wasn't necessary. The dean at Skagit was so impressed with Lexington's determination, he not only granted him admission, but he also offered him a scholarship, any job that would pay for his room and board. Once again, today's podcast is titled Overcoming Limiting Beliefs for Now and 2022. Another piece of, now imagine now, this dude had to walk 1,000+ miles. To get a scholarship. He didn't play basketball. He wasn't an athlete. He didn't get an academic one. He had to walk 1,000 miles. A lot of that would be what I call off the grid in Africa. Places that had little or no infrastructure. Wild animals that you see in a zoo, and probably some animals that you've never seen or even imagined before. He encountered all of it. Going to little small villages and tribes, whereas I read that many times he didn't even know the language, because there's over 2,000 indigenous languages spoken in Africa alone. Another piece of Lexington's dream had fallen into place. Yet, there were still more obstacles that blocked his path. Lexington needed a passport and a visa. But to get a passport, he had to provide the government with a verified birth date. Worse yet, to get a visa, he needed a round-trip airfare ticket to the United States. Again, he picked up a pen, paper, and wrote to missionaries who had taught him since childhood. They helped push the passport through the government channels. However, Lexington had lacked the airfare required and a visa. There's a saying that I've been going by lately out of scripture, based on this character in, I believe, Judges 3:13, Shamgar. And his three principles of success is, number one, start where you are. And Lexington apparently did that on several occasions. He started right from where he was at. Number two, he used what he had.
He had two books, an axe, a small ration of food. Well, the food ran out after 5 or 6 days. A little water. Remember, water is heavy. But that carried him to his next destination, where he got more resources and networked. I mean, he even got sick. Some places he had to stay for like 6 months or so. But he started with where he was, he used what he had, and he did what he could. He got the scholarship by, I mean, he didn't have the money, he didn't have the contacts, there was no cell phone or no internet access when he was doing all this. But he had two legs, he had his good health to walk that 1,000 miles. That's what he could do. He could get to the library, and he could read. And he got a hold of a pen or a piece or a pencil, some stationery to write with, and enough postage. That's how he got the scholarship. Start where you are. Use what you have and do what you can. And the universe will take care of the rest. In any event, let's see, going back to this. Okay. Undeterred, Lexan continued his journey to Cairo, believing, now he hadn't even made it to Cairo. Once again, that's beyond the span from New York to San Francisco. All right. Believing he would somehow get the money he needed. He didn't know how he was going to get it. He just believed he was going to get it. He was so confident that he spent the last of his savings on a pair of shoes so he wouldn't have to walk through the door at Skagit College. Rob, how do you pronounce that? Is it S-K-A-G-I-T, Skagit College, or Skagit Valley College, barefoot. That's something in itself. This dude's walking a good portion of his journey of 3,000 miles with no shoes. Months passed, and the word of courageous journey began to spread. By this time, he reached Khartoum, penniless and exhausted. The legend of Lexan Kiera had spanned the ocean between the African continent and Mount Vernon, Washington. The students at Skagit Valley College, with the help of local citizens, sent $650 to cover Lexan's fare to America. When he learned of this generosity, Lexan fell to his knees in exhaustion, joy, and gratitude. In December of 1960, more than 2 years after his journey began, Lexan Kiera arrived at Skagit Valley College, carrying his two treasured books. He proudly passed through the towering entrance of the institution, but Lexan Kiera didn't stop once he graduated. Continuing his academic journey, he became a professor of political science at Cambridge University in England and a widely respected author like his heroes, Abraham Lincoln and Booker T. Washington. Lexan Kiera rose above his humble beginnings, forged on to his destiny, made the difference in the world, and became a magnificent beacon of light that remains a guide for others to follow. I learned I was not, as most Africans believe, the victim of my circumstances, but the master of them. And those are the words of Kara Lexon. And he's got a book. He's transitioned out of this phase of life. But he's got a book. I'm opening up my phone, that you can get on Amazon. I believe the book is titled "I Will Try." You know what? I need to spend probably this afternoon and this evening. I might even binge read, or reread, I should say, that book. He didn't blame the white man. He didn't blame white supremacy. He didn't have Uber. He didn't have Lyft. There was no Greyhound. There was no Megabus. He had no internet connection. Smartphones hadn't been invented yet, nor laptops, nor desktops. Yet, he walked 3,000 miles. And that wasn't his full journey. That was the major first leg of his journey, walking 3,000 miles. And there's a lot of us that, you know, we're not going to even walk 3 miles. Let's see, I'm on my phone. And I'm pretty, I will try. Yep. I need to reread it. If you go to Amazon and go to your Kindle, I highly recommend you can buy the book, or you can, I think they'll send you one or two copies. Not one or two copies. I think you can probably download for free at least one chapter. And the book is titled "I Will Try." Actually, he did more than try. He will do. He did. But it's you can probably get one. "I Will Try" by Lexon. That's Legson. That's his first name, Lexon Kayira, and that's spelled K-A-Y-I-R-A. K-A-Y-I-R-A. I will try. And at the beginning of the book, before he gets into the, the content of the book, He writes, well, here's the full title. The main title is "I Will Try." Subtitle is "How I Learned I Was Not, as Most Africans Believe, the Victim of My Circumstances, but the Master of Them." Any self-limiting beliefs that he had, he got rid of. So going into 2020, well, matter of fact, this year is not over yet, because this month of November 2021 is not over yet. Sit down with a piece of paper and write down some of your limiting beliefs. Now, you'll be able to identify some of these real easy. Like, for instance, if you want to do something and you say, well, I don't have the money to do it, that thought of you believing you don't have the money to do it That's your particular limiting event. I mean, a belief. You need to reframe that, change your language, and put it out there. How can I afford this? What can I do to afford this? Or what do I need to do to get this, that, or whatever? You need to change around your vocabulary, even if you got to come up with some positive affirmations and just repeat it till you're blue in the face every day until you actually believe in a different way. All right. But let's see. Pretty healthy book. It's divided into four parts. And matter of fact, where he started off from, Nassiland, oh, let me see. I don't know if I'm butchering that. Okay. I'm trying my way with this. All right. Nassiland, okay. All right. Nyasaland, that could be it. It's a British protectorate located in Africa. It was established in 1907 when the former British Central African... Well, there's a map of this place on Wikipedia. And let me spell it out. It's spelled N-Y-A-S-A-L-A-N-D. Nyasaland, and there's a map of it online, and that's where Lexan, he started. So if you get a map of Africa, and just visualize, that's how far that guy walked. I mean, this dude walked a significant chunk, or stretch is a better word, of a continent. Yeah, if you go to Wikipedia and then Nyasaland is N-Y-A-S-A-L-A-N-D, one word. What is it today? Have they renamed that? Is that Nyasaland's history is marked with massive loss of African communal lands in the early colonial ages. In January, this is a whole, but we're not going to do this all today. Historic population, land use. Colonial, we're going to have to come back because there's a lot to this. But he walked that, man. So this dude walked, are you willing to, I went to my college. I flew from Washington, D.C. to Amarillo, Texas. And then somebody picked me up at the airport to ride me from the airport in Amarillo to Canyon, Texas. I didn't walk that. Matt, you know what? And I've never done this. Let me look at the distance. Canyon, Texas, where I went to undergraduate school. To Washington, D.C. Here, I'm looking at Lexan, man. We do not allow the pandemic. Don't use the pandemic for excuses. I'm guilty myself. I've done it. Okay. From Washington, D.C. to Canyon, Texas, is 1,614.5 miles. Okay. And I never walked that distance, never thought about. The most I've ever walked at any one stretch is 26 miles. I did that for the March of Dimes, you know, as a fundraiser. 26 miles. And only start really to get a drink of water here and there. That was about it. But I've never thought about walking anywhere close to this distance. He walked damn near double that. So I think we know what we're going to follow. We're going to read a little bit out of Crip, if not every day, his book, I Will Try. Because he's a good example of, and I'll read his word again. The subtitle of the book, I Will Try. I learned I was not, as most Africans believed, the victim of my circumstances, but the master of them. And one of the, in my opinion, the problems in the African-American community is some of us are professional victims. Let's see. Now, before I go to the phone lines here, a little bit of trending topics. All right, the Ohio case, the Wisconsin case. That's concluded. The Ahmaud Arbery trial. What did they do today? You know what? I got to catch up on that. Anyway, let's. 313. Hold. Give me a moment. Okay. Give me a moment. That's who I'm coming to. All right. We'll go through whatever you want to talk about, trending topics. The Ahmaud Arbery case. I'm not up on that. I was trying to scan the headline on YouTube. All right. Here's what I'm going to do. I got to take a bathroom break for 2 minutes. So y'all do the same thing. Get a cup of coffee, second cup of coffee, get some water, whatever. I will be back right after this interlude. Bye. Okay, back, overcoming limited to believe. All right, anyway, we did that part. Okay, the trending topic is, I guess, the Ahmaud Arbery case, or if you guys want to, you know, what's his name? The Kyle case is over with, but we'll probably have some, well, you know, it's Thanksgiving week, so we'll have people that talk about that. In any event, good morning, 314.
The kid is a Boy Scout. Talk about grace. The boy is got.
Okay, well. Man, I'm bored, bro.
Yeah, LA, you call me?
Yeah. Anyway, any comments for today? Hello? Oh, wait a minute, dog. Oh, hold on a minute, Pianchi. My board tripped out, and then I pressed the wrong button, too. Wait, I'm waiting for this. This board freezes up occasionally with Blog Talk. So I'm just waiting for it to unfreeze, and then I can get you back in. Okay, I got you. Yeah.
Hello? Yeah, that was a good... good music you was playing early. What's the name of that song?
I can't. Which one? Reach.
The last one.
Oh,
what was it?
Reach? Brazilian Rhyme by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
You it's know, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Brazilian. Earth, Wind, and Fire has some American classics.
They sure did.
Like, Hearts of Fire.
Yep. You're right. They had a lot
classic.
Of hits.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, a lot of hits.
And I think I told you yesterday, the Animals, that white group, they had...
I remember them.
Yeah, they had American classic too, The House of the Rising Sun. Man, that is a good song. Earth, Wind, and Fire is one of them songs that takes you back. And you know, Junior Walker, Way Down Home.
He's going back in the time machine. You know, I'm still playing that stuff.
Bruce Springsteen, Born in America.
Yeah, that's a good album.
It's a lot of good, and especially Big Man that played with Bruce Springsteen that blew the sax.
Oh, I know what you're talking about, Clarence Clemons.
Clarence Clemons. I think his son played with him now.
Maybe,
because
I think Clarence passed away a few years ago.
Yeah,
didn't
he did. It was a shame, wasn't it?
Yeah. Clarence Clemons. I think Clarence's son, or one of the, I don't know how many children he has, I think Bruce Springsteen's his godfather.
Yeah, I like Bruce Springsteen. Like I say, American, Born in America is a tough song, especially when you look at the time frame. It was really, and what he's saying. So it's a lot of songs out there like that.
Well, that's true, and I'm going to have to... Get them uploaded and play them. Get something.
And you know that kid that you was talking. What you say? Which way? Which direction did he go when he left Uganda?
The guy from Africa.
He left Nazi land. Nazi land is in Kenya.
Yep, East Africa.
Yeah, I've been there. I wouldn't want to live there though, but it's just too barren. That's a place where kind of time, some areas is where time forget. Which direction did he go? You say he was going to Cairo?
He walked from there to Cairo.
Yeah, well, he should have got on the boat and came down the Nile River.
He did. I'm just going by what I read. He didn't have the funds.
Yeah, he could have.
His parents didn't have the funds.
He could have hitched a hike. I tell you what, if I was younger...
Mm-hmm.
If I was younger,
that was something I would do again. I didn't do it like I wanted to, well, like I knew it to. But that's fun, going to
hiking
or near Lake Victoria, Lake Nzanya is what the real name of it. Right there. At,
well, we're when hearing a story like that, I'm looking at we got all these.
That's a good
conveniences. Yeah, we got all these modern conveniences. We really shouldn't be. And like you said, not everybody's alike. So not everybody's complaining.
Well, no, they're not. These people that complain probably don't have, especially the older folks, they made some wrong turns in their life on their own accord, and now they're pissed off. But that's all right. That's what life, I mean, life is a throw of the dice. And the United States at this point in time in history for the last several hundred years is the best country on earth with the promises it has. You got idiots like they're doing in New York, City Hall, taking down Thomas Jefferson's statue. Yeah, Thomas Jefferson was one of the authors of all the protections that we have today. And
well, what do they call it? We're in an age of what, cancel culture, as they call it?
Well, it's C-A-N-C-E-L, but actually it's C-A-N-C-E-R is what it is. Just like this idiot yesterday. This black guy, not yesterday, but he ran through that parade and harmed all those people. That guy's a racist. You see, you say racist, can't remember. He's a racist. I think he's a black militant, black supremacist, all those things. Crosses his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he's a damn fool.
Yeah, I agree with that. Definitely.
Use black privilege. Look at his rap sheet that he has. Everything from having sexual contact, producing a baby with a 15-year-old in Nevada, and now he leaves it to society to take care of. And he couldn't take care of it if he wanted to. He's a damn demon.
Well, he's locked up now.
Yeah, well, go to show you about this system. And some of these things we've seen come along with wanting no cash bail, ideas, defund the police, dissolve the police.
Yeah. Well, and I just heard, you might know more about this than me. When it comes to defunding the police, if that does happen in a few isolated places, that might come to, all right, well, they'll take away from, instead of taking away from, the manpower, they might move, or they're not putting the money towards the helicopter or things like that.
Could you imagine not having a helicopter with Los Angeles Police Department? As
well,
many
yeah,
court
LA,
cases
LA, New York, I'm sure St. Louis, you need a helicopter in those places.
Based on the population. Yeah, they don't have them in St. Louis because the people that's committing these crimes ain't that sophisticated. They ain't running no place. But in L.A., they running south, headed back across the border, a lot of them. So they got to have a helicopter there. And look at the stretches in the highway system that they got in L.A. And I like the way you said that. You said that what you just spoke on was done so very intelligent. You said some. You said some are doing these things because all blacks don't do these things. All blacks, quote unquote, not the same. They didn't come from the same place. They wasn't singing the same language. They don't have the same curse that's lingering in their DNA.
Mm-hmm. And that even goes with the white folks, because if you look at the one example I use,
it's over
the
human beings.
Man, we're talking about all these countries. And predominantly, as we would call them, white, they different political ideologies, different languages, and that's why, in my opinion, the Soviet Union. But matter of fact, one of the guests I had on here last week, I'm going to bring him back, because he lived in,
Russia.
Or he lived in Russia, but I don't know if he lived in Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. He's an American citizen from birth, but he had...
Yeah, he had to live under the USSR. Union Soviet Socialist Republic is what it was with those after World War II. Combine those countries, which they should have done, and I'm really glad they did, because after Germany ravaged them, they weren't able to support themselves. They had to come together the way they are, and they were surrounding Russia. Russia had to do in order to further protect itself, reestablish this buffer zone.
Now, do you think, I don't know how much the talk is on this at this point, do you think there will ever be, well, not ever, let's say in the foreseeable future, let's say 20 years, that there will be a United States of Africa?
No.
Okay.
No, because Africa, see, United States is a country. What you Definitely. Call the United States is a country, and that's located not entirely
on a continent,
Hawaii,
North America, right?
On a continent of North America, whose citizens are United States citizens. Now, technically, but to be more precise, the United States consists of about 11 countries, really. When you look
Wait,
at them.
Include what, the Caribbean and South America?
No.
I mean, not Central America.
No, you got the Yankeedom, you got the Southern, you got the Eastern, Maine, Vermont, Delaware. You go out west, you got a whole different attitude. On the in the Northwest, you go out west, you got a different attitude. You go down the Southwest. So if you look at all those different areas, look at the culture, look at the ideology, the thought pattern, you got about 11 different countries along cultural basis. People in Vermont, Maine, and Connecticut is anti-death penalty. You go down to Florida, they love old Sparky. I ain't going to say they love it, but they will use it, and they talk about bringing back some elements of it. Now, from a governmental position, the United States consists of 50 sovereign states.
That is true.
50 sovereign states, and they control the federal government. Actually, you got three areas of power. You got we the people, you got the sovereign states, and then you got the federal government. Federal government is not supposed to control the states. States control the federal government. Some people got it backwards, and you can just hear
I had it backwards. I thought it was the other way around. See, you broke it down.
If states control the federal government, that's where the federal government gets its power.
Okay.
States have no business dictating to the federal government in the ways that I've seen. Like they're trying to get this John Lewis voting bill. That's not going to go no place. That power lies within the state, in the state legislature, the state constitution, which allows a Atlanta to exist. It allows a Savannah to exist. It's the state constitution that allows a St. Louis to exist. And its villages, its municipalities, and cities. That's the state constitution. And within each one, it allows them to form a policing mechanism. And two, that state constitution allows them to dissolve that government and everything. They like give their power to the people.
Okay.
Not the federal government. So in a good example of good governance is DeSantis in Florida and Abbott in Texas, and also you got the good governance in Missouri, Parson, who tell the federal government to go to hell. But you're supposed to tell them because they're out of bounds.
Right.
The states give us this power because the state sends the legislature, not the legislature, but your congressperson, and it sends your U.S. Senate. Actually, the legislature used to appoint the U.S. senator way before they were up for a vote. But now they're up for a vote by the state. And that's that need to come back, I think, because, well, you don't know. But the stuff that you see going on now in this country, they're going to have to start cracking down hard. If not, the people are going to take control of it themselves. If the authorities don't do it, and of course the 10th Amendment gives, the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution gives the people the power to do that. If you ain't getting it out of the, at the government level, then you take control of it yourself.
Right. Oh, just on a sidebar, this is a trending topic. Malcolm X's daughter, or one of his daughters.
Yeah, she found dead. Think it was some foul play there?
She found dead yesterday.
Might be some foul play there because they come commuting the ones that were supposed to have been the ones that murdered him. They kind of let them wipe their slate clean.
Yeah, that happened, what, last week? And Malika Shabazz, daughter of Malcolm X, was found dead in her Brooklyn, New York home Monday. Shabazz, 56, was found by her daughter just before 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
That was the youngest one. You know, the son, the grandson, he got killed down in Mexico.
Now, was that the grandson that killed... set the fire to kill the Betty
Shabazz? That's the one that I'm not sure, but I think it was. Okay. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think that boy's got some problems. Matter of fact, they all might have some. I don't know.
Well,
things happen. Well, how we come along with our project, man? How many units you got?
Well, I got a call back on some campers today, and then I got a call that I'm going to have Robin call. We'll explain that tomorrow. Somebody called that was interesting. It was a woman, though. So I told Robin about it, and I'm if she hasn't called already.
All right.
See what about that.
We'll talk about that tomorrow. I'm interested to see how that's going on. And
okay. Yeah, because I need that like yesterday. In any event, thank you, Pianchi. Thank you all for listening. Everyone have a good rest of today.